Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
A Buccaneer pilot's first flight with an instructor in the back was kind of an authorised near-death experience. There was no dual control. You know, it was the stuff of air shows. It made good air show displays, mock attacks by the Royal Marines. I just had that little boy crying out feeling of, I want my dad. And from that point on, I had to find out what had happened.
Welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. In the book, Royal Navy Cold War Buccaneer Pilot, author Simon Kershaw helps us to relive the story of his father, Steve Kershaw, flying the mighty Buccaneer. Much of the tale comes from Steve's own notes and memoirs and is then picked up by Simon's analysis of his final flight. Simon Kershaw joins us today to help rekindle the story of his father's adventures. Simon, welcome to Extended.
Thank you very much, Peter. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you on. Fabulous book. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Let's do the chronological order of how your father, Steve, got into the service. But where did his interest in aviation come from?
I suspect it was in part from his father, who was an RAF air traffic controller in the Second World War. And he saw active service in Alexandria and after the war remained as a Royal Navy Royal Air Force volunteer reservist into the early 60s. Allied to that, I know my dad was very much into cars, engines, mechanics of all kinds. So I think it was a combination of those two. But I think his early interests were in being a seagoing officer. That's why he joined the Royal Navy in 1963. So his interest in flying kind of fermented and developed throughout his early years in the Navy, possibly through his peer group as well. There's a guy that comes up in early letters to his parents called Robin. I suspect that to be Robin Cox, who later emerges in many of the anecdotes of the voyages of Eagle and Ark Royal. It appears Robin was on a short service commission to be a Fleet Air Arm pilot. My father did flying early on at Roebra during his first 2 years as a trainee naval officer. So I think it all came together during the first couple of years. And I get the feeling that he had it in his mind that after a good solid grounding as a seagoing officer, that he would go for fixed wing flying training.
Yeah. So where did this fixed wing flying training start? Because he was in the Navy and then he went to look to get into the Fleet Air Arm, didn't he?
Yes. So he commenced his fixed wing training in 1968, July 1968. He was at the time navigating officer on a minesweeper, HMS Stubbington, stationed at Halfar in Malta. I suspect that he was just marking time there and his application was in because I do have his notification to go and join fixed wing flying training 141 Naval Air Course at Linton-on-Ouse.
Yeah.
So I think it was years in the making and it started with those early flights at Roebra as a trainee naval officer when still at Dartmouth.
Yeah. Now, I mean, I'm jumping the gun here, but I think one of the characteristics that comes out from his flying is he was always near the top end of the class. He certainly seems to come across as being a certainly an accomplished flyer. But the key thing about the way the book is constructed is you use his memoirs, his notes, and to bring the story to life. How was that for you, here reading all of those notes and pulling together what's turned out to be a whole book of his life stories?
Yes, I would say it's the nearest I could get to time travel currently available. It was a more or less conscious decision to go and chronologically read through the whole of that stock of letters. I was aware of its existence. I had been for many years, and yeah, I dip sampled them in ones and twos over the years. I suspect emotional barriers had prevented me from actually going through the whole lot, but I knew about them. I knew where they were, and it had got to the point in my life where I wanted to know a lot more about my dad as an adult.
Right.
My relationship with him, should we say, was on pause as a five-year-old, you know, dad to his five-year-old son. But I wanted to know the kind of dad that maybe I could have gone out and had a beer with,
yeah,
took career advice from, etc. So I wanted that adult knowledge. And I think the other factors came in, like my own children becoming more independent and growing up, and a sense that I was actually getting to the age where I was old enough to have been my dad's dad.
Yeah,
and the read through was kind of a strange mixture of reading through as he's my dad, I'm the little boy again, he's my dad, but also I was reading through in a peer-to-peer style, but also in a bit of a fatherly way, because yeah, I was a late 40 something year old starting to read through my dad's 23 as a 23 year old letters written at, yeah, sea. So it's surreal, like time travel, highly immersive, and it kind of triggered what the backstory to this book really is, which is a weird tale of an imaginary collaboration with my dad. He's like, yeah, in spirit, been there with me both on the page and kind of sitting with me,
yeah,
stepping in and out of the shadows and almost going through his naval career with me.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks for sharing that, Simon. Really appreciate that. And just one final question on that, just before we go back to his story, because we want to hear how exciting it was, because he did live an exciting time. Yeah. Was did you read it right through? Was there did you feel the need to sort of get the whole group of his stories read and digested, or did you do it piecemeal? How was that?
It was from start to finish. My priming experiences were over the years. I'd read a few of them, and I tended to actually go back to the same few, probably for no more reason than they were on the top or near the front of the drawer.
Yeah.
There's an antique drawer in Suffolk that forever holds my dad. and I phrase it in similar style in the opening chapter of the book.
Yeah.
But it was deeper into this stock were bundles, you know, done up in elastic bands. There were bundles that I knew were from the Eagle voyage, the, yeah, 8 month 1971 to 72 voyage. As I was feeling the need to, shall we say, get to know my dad as an adult, and it was a decision to go in there and start at the beginning. And at the beginning meant actually before the time span of the letter material that I use in the book, but I adapt that letter material to, yeah, be to come across as a condensed account drawn as if my dad is drawing from his own letters and recollections. Yeah. I have condensed, compressed, edited those letters. They're presented as if they're a retrospective, but those are from the early letters before we launch on the main voyage to Eagle. So I did read everything from 1968, flying training at Linton-on-Ouse,
yeah,
all the way through to late October 1974, the end of Art Royal, his final, as it turned out, his final embarkation.
Right. Well, let's go back and hear some of that story, because I really enjoyed, I got lost, actually. I knew how the book had been structured, but I got lost in his story. I really enjoyed his experiences. In some ways, they were, you know, there were mad dogs and Englishmen.
Yes.
There were young men, you know, having a good time.
Yeah.
There was the early father. But of course, this whole book is built around his flying.
Yes.
And as I said, he was a great pilot, always near the top of his class, very, very keen to make sure all his landings were accounted for, and particular.
Indeed.
He really was very particular about that. But let's talk about the story and after his flight training and where he went to, and eventually getting on to fly the Buccaneer. Can you just talk us through that early part of his career?
Yeah, so initial flying training in the Jet Provost aircraft was from July 1968 to May 1969 at Linton-on-Ouse, fairly near to Leeds, where he met my mother, as it turned out, who was teaching in Leeds at the time.
Right.
Then from Linton-on-Ouse, the intake, or those that survived, went to Broadie, South Wales, for advanced naval flying training on the Hunter.
Yeah.
And that was initially on the T8 two-seat trainer. They learned the basics of, I suppose you could say, combat flying and navigation. It appeared they then graduated onto the GA-11, the single seat, where they were allowed to let loose on their own.
Yeah.
And so I can see from, from his logbook and other memoirs I've read to get acquainted with the background of a flying training, that was really the kind of the transformation from someone who can fly an aircraft to someone who can fight in an aircraft, and a single seat aircraft if necessary. It all becomes rather more warlike. There's low level navigation, reconnaissance, attacks of different forms, as in gunnery, bombing, rocket attacks, all the standard weapons, air weapons of the time. And that took him up to February 1970. And February 1970, he moved from Broadie up to Lossiemouth. And there he joined 736 Squadron, which is the dedicated Buccaneer training squadron.
Yeah.
It was a naval squadron, but staffed in approximately equal measure by Royal Air Force and Royal Navy instructors. And indeed, the students were a mix, because the political backdrop was that the writing was on the wall for naval fixed wing flying and the carriers. So the recruitment flow was slowing down. Preparing to wind down the aircraft fleet and the fixed wing squadron. So the RAF were filling the personnel gap.
And he was very aware of the political dynamics, wasn't he?
He understood,
you know, the changes of government, the political parties, and he was watching them for their various impacts on the Royal Navy, and particularly, as you say, on fixed wing flying. I thought that was quite interesting.
I like many of his peers, I suspect, he was no fan of the Wilson government.
No, I think that's quite clear.
The various Wilson governments that really sort of started to deconstruct the Navy and deprive them of their most expensive strategic toys.
But in true British fashion, he writes very eloquently to disguise, I think, that it's more of an awareness of the political environment rather than, I don't like what they're doing, this is going to have an impact on me. It was more, oh, that's an interesting observation that could impact us in probably only the only way a Royal Navy British officer could do.
Yes, I don't know the details of my father's politics, but clearly, anyone serving at the time is going to become rather concerned at the news that aircraft carrier projects are being scrapped, serving carriers are due to be scrapped, therefore fixed wing squadrons are going to be decommissioned. That so where were we? We're on 736.
We're in Lossiemouth.
We're up in Lossiemouth,
which comes up.
736 squadron. Yes. Yeah. 736 squadron at Lossiemouth, the physical and spiritual home of the Buccaneer.
Yeah.
From February 70 into June, July 70. So that was the full operational conversion onto the Buccaneer, which still involved the British classic, the Hunter. Plenty of flying on the Hunter, especially early in the course. It, as a lot of people will know, it shared an instrument panel in common, the IFIS, Integrated Flight Instrument System. It shared that in common with the Buccaneer. So it was the nearest they had to an instructional, two-seat instructional aircraft. And then, again, for readers of Cold War aircraft memoirs, it's well known that a Buccaneer pilot's first flight with an instructor in the back was kind of an authorized near-death experience. There was no dual control. It was controlled solely by the backseat driving skills and persuasive patter of the instructor in the rear, in the observer's seat. There was much tactical and operational training with the Buccaneer over those few months, February to July, getting into that, learning how to fly and fight it as a low-level, high-speed strike aircraft, as it was designed to be. Yeah. And that took us up to summer 1970 when he was he successfully completed that. That was the formal end of his 141 Naval Air Course. That was the formal end of that, and he was posted to 800 Naval Air Squadron.
Yeah.
Embarked on HMS Eagle, but at that time set to spend several months into 1971 shore-based at Lossiemouth.
Yeah, and jumping on to the time on the Eagle, he went on what must have been, for a young man, a most amazing trip around the world that literally saw them circumnavigate the world.
Yes, amazing. There were two workups prior to that, which are told in compressed form in the first chapter of the book, one in home waters, for the second one, they went to Gibraltar and Malta. So it was for about, it was November to December 1970 was the first workup in home waters. Notable for a tragedy, Sea Vixen on 11th of November, or no, it was 13th of November, sorry. A Sea Vixen crashed into the sea shortly after takeoff, resulting in the loss of the pilot, Bruce Harrison. And his observer, Jeff Hamlin, miraculously survived, thankfully, in large measure due to the plane guard helicopter being overhead and the winchman getting onto Jeff in the water very quickly. Inflating his life jacket for him, separating him from the seat. That was an early tragedy there.
And I think that sort of encapsulates a lot of what's in the book in terms of the stories that your father tells as he goes on this journey. There's a lot of detail like that. There are times when there are little gaps, but in effect, you get the whole story of almost every day of his life on that cruise. Particular attention, obviously, to the flying. And it was becoming very clear to me as a reader that he was loving the Buccaneer. He was loving the flying. And as he developed more and more of his flying capabilities, the low-level flying that we all know and love to talk about for the Buccaneer became a speciality for him, and he became more and more competent. You could see his skills and his experience develop throughout the cruise.
Yes, that's right. He adored the flying, and was very miserable when there was no flying going on. One has to make the story engaging, but also I did want to convey something of the boredom, But he moped. he went into the dumps sometimes quite deeply and moaned to my mother in letters, and she would give him some kind of encouragement and telling off and some sort of pull yourself together sort of address. But he loved the flying. That's what he was there for. He was already an experienced seagoing officer. He'd been abroad. He'd been based at Malta, so being embarked was nothing new for him. He'd even been on Ark Royal before when she was in home waters as part of his navigating officer training.
Okay.
So that was years earlier, circa 66, 67. He was in it for the flying. He writes with great enthusiasm about the Buccaneer. He said even before he first climbed into one, from what we've seen in ground training, it's very impressive and I can't wait to start flying on the Buccaneer.
Clearly
he was happy to be flying what at the time was a modern cutting edge aircraft, which he occasionally compares, not unfavorably, but he highlights the difference between that, the Buccaneer, and the Sea Vixen, talking about the Sea Vixen as rather an old aircraft compared to the Buccaneer's modern systems.
Again, that British politeness comes through. Not taking away from the fact here, we're not covering everything in a lot of detail. For those who want to go out and buy the book, there's a great deal of coverage of the Buccaneer, the flying, some of the techniques, some of the challenges he had. And of course, they had at the time problems with the engines as well. And that was a real big frustration for him, because they had to limit the life of the engines at one time, which meant, as you said earlier, less flying. And he almost always got a flight, but when he didn't, because of that, he, as you said, he was pretty down in the dumps. But bringing the personal aspect back, he was also a very young father at that time, wasn't he?
He'd have been 23, nearly 24 at my birth.
And he, I think what also comes across is his humanity, because often when we read fighter pilot books, for want of a better description, there's a great deal of bravado around the technology, around the aircraft, about the capabilities, and of course aviation enthusiasts lap that stuff up. But this is a story about a person and a life. And that comes across very much in the book. You get the flying, you get the technical stuff, but you also get the pain he feels when, you know, he's in Australia or New Zealand. He couldn't be further from home and he's not had a letter. Of course, no internet and no satellite phones in those days. So you're literally waiting on some hard copy to arrive. And that really comes across how tricky, you know, it is. And we look back on a lot of these sorts of incidents and these cruises as being really exciting. And I talked about it.
Yes.
But it comes across how lonely at times, how much he misses home, how much he misses his wife and his family as well. It's a real human story.
That's right. I think it's a floating city. The aircraft carrier, be it Eagle, Hermes or Ark Royal, it's a floating city of young men united in loneliness. they have so much male companionship and they have such a lot of fun, but also there is crushing homesickness. And it comes across at times. And I think the beauty of having this archive of letters is that they weren't written with machismo. They weren't written with any thoughts of showing off or emphasizing the masculine aspects of Royal Navy flying. They were letters to my mother, to his wife, with all the kind of cares and concerns, but also, and this is where it's kind of quite funny, and I'm eternally grateful to my dad, he wrote so much detail about operational matters. My mother wasn't interested. She has joked about that many times.
Yeah.
I mean, she wanted to know what he was up to. She wanted to hear from him. And I think this discipline of writing every other day was a kind of a negotiated settlement. I think she'd have quite happily had one a day. But what did he have to write about? He wrote about what he loved, which was far more operational, incidental detail than my mother ever cared for it.
Yeah.
I wanted to know. As she said before, he wrote to me as if I was another pilot.
Yeah.
And for me, whether or not it was in his mind, I don't know, but it's like he was partly writing to me in the future. Perhaps also he was wanting to set it down as a diary for future self-reflection.
Yeah.
A diary of his time, of what he sensed, quite rightly, would be the time of his life. But I'm very grateful for all that excess of detail that wives just don't want to know.
No, it was great. I loved it too. But I loved the balance. I loved the balance between the story of his life, for want of a better description, and that technical and that aviation-based content.
Yes, yes. There's always a thread, an umbilical cord going back to Lossiemouth. There's always these touchstones, their comments on the news he's received in or questions he's asking about home life. So whilst we're on the carriers and that's how I want it to come across, I want the reader to feel like they are there. In framing this, I want the reader to feel they're a VIP aboard the carrier, maybe flying in every couple of days and receiving a one-to-one briefing, that kind of thing. But also, Lossiemouth is always a presence, or Yeovilton, or Honington. Wherever home is there. But of course, it would have been a presence for all of them. Wherever they were, they're in this steel jungle, but home is a ghost that's hanging around over everybody. Yeah. Everyone's wanting to get back. When everyone's away, they want to be back home. And arguably, when they're back home, they want to be away. But such is life.
Did you know that during the Falklands War in 1982, there was a plan to put the Black Buck raids on steroids by sending an Avro Vulcan to bomb airfield targets on mainland Argentina, potentially returning to RAF Waddington the long way round via Chile, Easter Island, Tahiti, Hawaii, the USA and Canada? Did you also know that during the Second World War, a proposal was made to build B-29 superfortresses in the UK, powered by Bristol Centaurus engines? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
Aviation media has long been the domain of the newspapers and magazines.
Well, not anymore. I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran, and we're bringing aviation right into your radio.
Yes, we're making aviation cool and interesting for everyone.
Hang on, aviation's always been cool. Check this out.
How cool is this?
Grant, turn that down. Here at Plane Crazy Down Under, we've got pilots, engineers, air traffic controllers, industry leaders, even politicians dropping by to talk to us about the amazing world of aviation right here in Australia and occasionally in New Zealand as well.
Wow, that's cooler than I thought, mate.
Find us at planecrazydownunder.com, on iTunes, or lurking about on other people's podcasts just like this one.
We've got crazy accents and lots of great aviation content.
And we promise not to talk about the cricket.
No, never, not the cricket.
Quack, 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 quack.
What is cricket anyhow?
Something we win a lot. Oh, there
we go.
He returns to Lossiemouth and he then goes to convert to rotary. So, and I'm jumping well ahead here because I feel like the listeners need to buy the book to read the flying stories. There's a lot in there. There's a great deal. So there's a little bit of a tidbit for them. You need to read it to digest it. But as you say, he came back to to Lossiemouth. Why did he look to convert back to, or why did he look to convert to rotary wing? What was behind that decision?
That was career progression. So my dad joined the Royal Navy as a generalist executive officer. So he was in the Navy for a long-term career. He would therefore naturally progress through several departments. And when flying was his chosen path, part of the broad exposure to naval flying would be helicopters, the rotary wing world. He would have happily gone to the United States and flown the A6 Intruder, the Grumman Intruder, which is talked about as the US equivalent of the Buccaneer, but with more advanced avionics.
But not as cool.
Of course not.
Not as cool.
Not as exclusive. But there was a possibility of that because on the latter parts, the latter stage of the Eagle voyage, John Manley, the appointer, came to see everyone to tell them where they'd be going after 800 Squadron was disbanded. And it was raised as a possibility that he might go to fly the Intruder. However, when it came down to it, someone else got that appointment. And my father was posted to helicopters. So it was part of a wide exposure. And he also had his eye on the Harrier, which was in RAF service and was being trialed in the late 60s, early 70s. I'm no expert, but it was known about, it was around, and it was on the cards that the Harrier, a naval version of the Harrier, was in development. It was trialed. I'm not sure when he was ever embarked, but he would have been aware of it being trialed on one of the carriers. So he had his eyes on that, and he felt that fixed wing and rotary wing experience conveniently would be a passport to the Harrier. Of course, he had little choice. He was a generalist officer, wanted to fly. He was going to end up being on a naval air commando squadron. He was going to fly helicopters, be it in a commando or anti-submarine role. You know, there's no getting away from it, even if he'd wanted to carry on in fixed wing.
Yeah. And he did, of course, end up flying in the commando environment. But he also got to fly some pretty cool helicopters before that as well. He ended up on the Wessex Mark 5, I think.
Yeah, the HU HER-5, Helicopter Utility 5. Yes, the commando variant of the Wessex.
But he got to fly the Whirlwind and some other cool helicopters beforehand.
Yes, the Hillman Hiller seemed to be the initial training helicopter. Then they progressed to the Whirlwind before the Wessex. Another great classic.
And again, once he'd converted to the HU-5 to become a commando pilot, again, it comes across in the book, his desire to be really good at what he does.
Yeah.
He was very passionate about the flying, to get it right, his responsibilities. And of course, he was starting to get a new responsibility by not only flying with himself and an observer, he was now flying lots of others as well. Yes. And again, that sort of thing comes through in the way he talks about his flying. You know, it was really important in this really bad weather to get them to this place. And he did some really exciting flying, didn't he?
Yes, weather was a challenge up near, northern Norway, of course.
Yeah.
It was exercise, clockwork and cold winter, heavily involved with ferrying the Royal Marines around 4-5 Commando, based at Arbroath.
Yeah.
Cold winter, certainly clockwork is an exercise that still runs. So there's a long history now of 4-5 Commando and that exercise in Norway. He says he prefers the Buccaneer. He says a couple of times, I can't wait to get back to Buccaneers. But he really threw himself into commando helicopter flying. The Royal Marines are like the guest stars of that chapter. Embarked on Hermes with 845 Naval Air Commando Squadron. They feature large. It's all about them. It's all about getting them offloaded and deployed and back on again. He flies in all weathers. Ends up nearly getting stranded at commando positions on a couple of occasions. And helicopters do. Helicopters are getting stranded left, right, and centre.
There's some great stories. Yeah, there are.
Challenging mountain flying, lifting guns, Land Rovers, men and stores, and the amusing instance, like people dropping loads and finding some excuse for why it was a technical issue, malfunction of some kind.
Yeah. He was very particular, and he was very clear about those sorts of things. But I thought, again, it was a really interesting dynamic. He'd gone from sort of that fast jet environment to a very, very different culture as well, you know, in the commando culture. And he sort of slotted right in.
He
became that jungly pilot straight away.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And I remember a sense of that. We were at Yeovilton, and, as his career progressed and I grew, my memories kind of emerged from the mists. And Yeovilton, I remember as this, it was the green phase. There was a lot of green stuff around. Be it Land Rovers, 105mm light guns, sections of Royal Marines, deploying at high speed out of these things. It was the stuff of air shows. It made good air show displays, mock attacks by the Royal Marines. Stuff came home, like little things you remember, like my dad coming home with a green commando sweater, the woolly pulley that everyone knows from the good old 70s and 80s of military service. And I think I was even dressed in this, and the arms, sort of coming right down and sort of trailing across the floor. And I'm lost in this heavy woolen jumper. Got this sense of suffocation and amusement. Bits of spent shell cases, inert ammunition. I just remember that it was all that commando environment. It was like half Navy, half aviation. No, sorry, part Navy, part aviation, and part Green Army.
Yeah, it was quite interesting, that bit. And it there were times when I was thinking, this is a different. It's like almost like a different person.
It is,
One time, because it's such a different culture from that sort of fast jet environment that he'd come from. But of course, he did go back to fast jets again. He spent his time. He did his commando work, but he went back to his beloved Buccaneer.
Yes, that's right. To 809 Squadron, the last remaining Buccaneer squadron by that time, based at Honington, where the RAF Buccaneer squadrons had set up since 1969. So that was the Lossiemouth, for the time being, was no longer its physical home. Although it there seemed to be a sense remaining of Lossiemouth as the spiritual home of the naval Buccaneer. It was course reports, and there's a document somewhere that I've temporarily lost, but I have seen it, where he's giving a view on his latest posting, and he says he was quite happy to go back to the Buccaneer, although he would have liked to have gone to a Harrier squadron. He'd have liked that, but he was quite happy to go back to the Buccaneer, as he'd still he'd only had two and a half years, operational experience on it. So he certainly wasn't. There was no sense I got that he was bored of Buccaneer flying. Far from it.
It came across that way. But he had to requalify. Had to go through the whole process.
That's right.
And it was a mixed environment, as you say. It was RAF and Navy.
Yes. Once again, so as it had been at 736 Squadron, the training squadron at Lossiemouth, training was now delivered at Honington by 237 Operational Conversion Unit, which was run by the RAF. And by this point, RAF aircrew made up about half of the strength of 809 Squadron. So it was remembered fondly by both RAF and Navy Aircrew as this time of light blue and dark blue uniforms around the place, and all operating in almost perfect harmony, which I think can only be a good thing, because the RAF were becoming masters of the aircraft.
Yeah.
And now the Royal Navy were outnumbered. There were, I think, three RAF Buccaneer squadrons at that time. And with their vast stock of expertise, aircrew, possibly who'd cut their teeth on the Canberra, it was inevitable that there'd be a complete cultural shift, and we'd end up, the Royal Navy would end up learning from the RAF.
Yeah. So he's back in the Buccaneer. He's well settled. He's comfortable. Tell us now about the Gilroy Trophy and how that came about. What it is.
So the Gilroy Trophy was in memory of a Buccaneer crew that was lost in January 1972, early January. That was following a weapons delivery manoeuvre on a range at Jura on the Isle of Man. And the Buccaneer flew into the sea at night, as I understand it. And the crew was squadron leader Jock Gilroy and observer, I'm in danger of saying the wrong Christian name. It was either Chris Wilborn or Tom Wilborn. And I apologize to anyone for one of those is wrong. Tragically, both crew were lost. And the Gilroy Trophy was in their memory. The prize was a sword, a magnificent silver sword, which still lives in the officers' mess at RAF Honington. A cabinet. It was the Gilroy Trophy was a competition. It was a competition between Buccaneer squadrons, which, of course, by 1974 amounted to about three RAF squadrons and 237 operational conversion unit and one single remaining Royal Navy Buccaneer Squadron 809. So no pressure. The 809 squadron air crews there. They wanted to do well, and that was coming in the autumn of 74 after they'd finished that final embarkation that my dad was on Ark Royal from September to beginning of November 1974. So all the flying from Honington after that was with the Gilroy Trophy in mind, early November.
It was getting competitive, but they were very focused. They were keen to make sure their skills were absolutely honed.
Yeah.
But, of course, they're an operational squadron as well, so part of the day job is tactical training. And let's talk now about the final part of the book, because I think it just needs a tiny bit of introduction, because it's very different from what we've seen of the story so far. We move into a different perception of how the whole incident comes about.
Yes.
But let's talk about what happened on that fateful evening when, unfortunately, the incident occurred.
Yes. So 809 Squadron flew off Ark Royal on Sunday, the 3rd of November, 1974, landed back at Honington. I was there together with families, my mother, my brother. We were there. All the families were gathered to watch the air crews, watch the squadron fly in. I remember that day very well. That was Sunday. The rest of that week, there was some flying. There was a brief from the air warfare instructor, Robin Cox, on the local ranges in preparation for the flying activities from Honington after this embarkation. So on the 6th of November, Wednesday, 6th of November, there was one flight. My dad did one flight with his observer, who by then was David Thompson. He was permanently crewed up with more or less throughout the previous embarkation on ARC. And there was a long weekend coming up, which would have been the 9th and 10th. Of November, yeah, Saturday and Sunday, 9th and 10th of November. David flew off to France to visit his family. We did various things. We had a quiet weekend, as I recall, and as has been I've pieced together subsequently. Monday, the 11th of November, it was back to work. My dad was due to be on a mission to Waynefleet Range. The flying program was fairly ordinary for 809 Squadron. There were a morning and an afternoon and a later afternoon flight on the program. Various crews were involved, some flying once, some flying more than once. My dad was due to fly at lunchtime. That was cancelled. David flew with another pilot mid-morning. Various ranges were used locally, Cowden, East Yorkshire, Waynefleet on the Lincolnshire coast, Holbeach again, Lincolnshire coast or the Wash coast. The last flight of the afternoon was the delayed flight from 1600 to 1630. Weather was a factor. There was a weather front that was clearing easterly. And the slot for this flight was delayed for till 1630 to 1700 Waynefleet. So the sortie was comprised of it was a four ship sortie was briefed initially, which was my dad, David Thompson, his observer. There was Stuart Leeming and his observer Dave Smith. Clive Morell and his observer Rosie Tyberg, I think the name is pronounced. And there was Mike Sharp and Tony Francis, but they didn't have an aircraft allocated. So it was a four-ship sortie, but only three took off. Gold Leader, that was my dad, and Gold 2 and 3, Stuart's aircraft and Clive's aircraft, took off just after 4 p.m. from Honington, and they headed for Holbeach. Crossed into the Wash via the North Norfolk coast, did a pre-range height check off the coast near Sheringham, I think. Headed to Holbeach. The aircraft were put in the hold at Holbeach because an RAF Buccaneer sortie was still on Waynefleet Range. So they went into a circuit at Holbeach. 25 past four, the serial was cleared to go over to Waynefleet, checked into the range. Immediately went into medium toss deliveries, a type of Buccaneer weapons delivery where the aircraft pulls up circa 3 miles from the target and lobs the bomb up and over onto the target.
Yeah.
They did four of those circuits in the medium toss delivery mode. Clive and Stewart's aircraft were then out of ordnance. They had four 25 pound practice bombs for medium toss bombing. All bombs gone. They checked out of the range. My father's aircraft had four pound practice bombs on board, which could be used for lay down bombing, which was also another briefed delivery method for the sortie. But as they were the only aircraft that had the right practice bombs, they were the only aircraft left on the range to go into lay down bombing circuits. They did one circuit, no issues whatsoever. Great maneuver. My dad was slightly tight on the turn onto the range marker at the Haven just southeast of Boston where the bombing run begins. He was slightly tight on the turn. But apart from that, he picked up the target easily. Flew the laydown profile perfectly, which is 420 knots speed and 150 feet bomb release height. The only issue is no splash smoke or flash was seen from the practice bomb, which was communicated by the range control tower, RAF Wainfleet, the towers near the parish of Wainfleet. So they got a no spot, and on the downwind leg, after they turned starboard away from the ship targets, they discussed whether to go around again, what the issue might have been. The two main causes of a no spot could be no bomb was released. It's a problem with the CBLS, with the bomb carrier. Maybe the practice bomb is hung up on the carrier, or it was dropped and it was a dud. What they decided to do, having assessed the conditions, the sunset and horizon were good to the southwest. Visibility was good. They decided to go around one more time, see if they could get a bomb off. And with that decision made on the downwind leg, they advised Wainfleet Control that they were going to go for final run, target three, ship target three for laydown attacks. And that was at 16:48. My dad committed to the final run. What he, the remainder of that maneuver is to fly southwest towards Hull Beach, and then a wide turn of about 3 miles to come over the range marker at the Haven near Boston, and then commence the attack run, which is virtually due north, northeast. Magnetic right. bearing 54 degrees back then, but now it's 45. It's true terms, it's northeast.
Yeah.
That's about nine miles from the marker to the ship target. So only a matter of a minute and a half to fly that. The turn was entirely normal. No issues with David didn't have to tighten my dad up. David was radar guiding my dad onto the line of attack. Yep. Flew over the finals marker on the right line of attack. My dad was having difficulty picking up the target. He said so when they were in the starboard turn coming over the marker. But they were on the right line of attack. It's a descending turn. There's a minimum brief height of 500 feet over the marker. And they were correct. They were correct right speed, right height over that marker. They continued along the line of attack for, I would estimate, about another 9 or so seconds. And my dad spotted the target, and he passed that over the intercom to David. He said, "Contact," or "I've got it," words to that effect. David was looking at the scope, checking they were on the line of attack. He then went, that was to his left in the rear cockpit. Then he went to his right to the blue jacket, to the ground position indicator, to check the ground speed. So they are preparing for the run now. They're preparing to go for it, get the speed and the height sorted out. They're on the line of attack. A few seconds later, as David is checking the ground speed, there is an enormous bang. And that's it for David. He has a sense of the cockpit falling away beneath him, but he blacks out. And the next bit of the story that we are aware of, that anybody can testify to, apart from range control, who've now lost radio contact with the aircraft, is David regaining consciousness, actually in the water, tumbling underwater, somersaulting underwater. He's blacked out, so he doesn't know how long he's been in that state. Somehow his life jacket inflates, he shoots to the surface, and he's tangled up in his parachute lines, he's tangled in the drogue lines, and that causes him severe problems because he can't sort himself out. He can't get proper buoyancy and get to a proper attitude in the water. So he kind of just lies there. There's not a lot he can do. He's getting cold, freezing cold. He can't feel anything. He can't locate his knife. He can't, because his left side is entangled in the drogue lines. He can't get at his personal locator beacon. He's reliant now on good fortune. And the good fortune is that there are still boats out on the wash. there are boat crews out there, and they've seen the aircraft come down. They've seen the fireball. They've seen a great cloud of water and steam go up, and they make towards that location.
And unfortunately, your father is lost in that accident. And I'm very sad. It was a very sad thing to read and to go through. But what you, the way you construct this element of the book, of the story, of the recall, is very different. I'd not read anything, and at first, as I started reading it, I wasn't quite sure what I was reading. But what you have been able to do is construct the detail of the incident. There is a lot of detail about what happened, why it might have happened, how things evolved. There's reconstruction of the accident investigation, the witness statements, and there were a number of witnesses, boats and things like that. But what you also do is you look at the incident through your father's or what is the perception of your father's experience of it.
That's right.
Which is it's quite an amazing read. I need to say, Simon, how did you feel about doing that? Because it's a tough read.
Mm. Yeah.
How was that to deal with for you?
Right. It evolved quite naturally, actually. The book project never started as a book project. It started in summer 2018. I think that's as good a start point as any, because of course, that accident and its outcome has never fully left me. But 2018, I found myself looking back increasingly. I was going through a period of, stress at work, and I think it came tumbling out that I wanted to talk to my dad. I just had that little boy crying out feeling of I want my dad. And from that point on, I had to find out what had happened. And I think it was because I'd been defeated for 44 years by the logic of, if I can't understand what happened, how it happened, it can't have happened, and yet my dad isn't around. But then he was away at sea a lot anyway. So, although as an adult, I could perfectly well rationalize it without needing to know all the detail. I hadn't lost this mistrust about the whole event, whether it had really happened or not, and I had to go back and find out what happened and talk to his mates, people who I hadn't seen for 40 years, who I had last talked to and remember as I was a 5-year-old boy, and they were, you know, they were my the other daddies, as it were. So it all started rolling from there, a very personal quest. It started with making contact with the Buccaneer Aviation Group, who keep two Buccaneers in ground running condition. I wanted to experience what it was like to at least run on the ground with one, and that was amazing. Very emotional, very exciting and emotional experience to ride in the back seat of a Royal Navy. It's actually an RAF Buccaneer, but they keep it in Royal Navy 809 Squadron colours. Running alongside that, I was requesting the information I needed, which was the Lincolnshire coroner's inquest papers, getting in touch with Stuart Leeming and Clive Morrell, who were on the flight on that sortie, and making arrangements to go to the Fleet Air Arm Museum at Yeovilton to go into their archives and get the Board of Inquiry report, which I have to say, I never expected to get access to that report so quickly. As an aside, for those who are interested in archives and research, it turns out that it wasn't locked in a Ministry of Defence vault somewhere. I wasn't going to have to wait for months and months of being told, no, we can't find it. It actually had been had come up for disposal in 2013 as a part of a bulk disposal of Ministry of Defence records. And the guidelines or policy and guidelines were that first they had to be offered to the National Archives, headquartered at Kew. But if Kew didn't want it, if the National Archives couldn't accommodate it, it should be offered to another appropriate archive. There was none more appropriate than the Fleet Air Arm Museum. So they had it. So I could not believe that actually within, I think, weeks, it was less than 2 months. Within less than 2 months, I was of inquiring. I was actually in Yeovilton in the archive, being very well looked after by Barbara and Catherine, the archivists there.
I know them.
They got it there. Barbara had checked through it, briefed me on what was in it and what wasn't in it, and basically and left me alone for as long as I needed. Made me coffee. And just left me there and did a mountain of photocopying. And I have to say, I've never studied anything so hard. A-levels, degree, any professional qualification doesn't even come close to how intensively I studied for that. That 8 hours or whatever, till literally I was almost thrown out, very politely, of course. I stayed till the last possible moment, and then retired to the pub. to the
well deserved
to the Podymoor with a you know, I don't think I think it's safe to say I was the only person dining in the Podymoor in that night with a Royal Navy Board of Inquiry report on my table. The second pint, it was starting to make sense. In danger of sort of going down this rabbit hole.
No, it's okay.
That was the accident research started off in earnest from those sort of three main sources, coroner's inquest file, Royal Navy Board of Inquiry report, the adjunct to that, the Royal Navy Accident Investigation Unit report, which is the technical report, which didn't come out until 1975. And the most important source of information was talking to his mates, Clive Stewart, pilots, experienced pilots, both as military pilots back in the day, and civil pilots for long careers after that. And of course, the most valuable conversation. Well, one of the most valuable conversations I've ever had and ever will have was with David Thompson, who was my dad's guy in the back, who survived the accident. And he told me about what happened.
And it is quite a piece of work that you've done, because you've managed to bring all of those source materials, live, historical, interview-based memories, all together. And you wrap it up, as I said, in the perception of your father having an overview of what is happening.
Yes.
And I think that's probably where I think I'd like to leave that, because I think you have to read it to experience it. But what I will say is, just personally, I'm really grateful to what you've had to do. And I send out my deepest condolences, because I found it a tough read, actually. But fascinating. I sort of couldn't put it down, bizarrely. So my thoughts go out to you and your family, but also I really commend you, Simon, for a fabulous piece of work. And if nobody wants to go out and buy the book up until this point, there's your reason to go out and buy it.
So
what I'd like to just start gently wrapping this up with is, one of the other things you've managed to do, you talked about David, you talked about some of the other people throughout the book, there are fabulous little anecdotes from the people who flew with him and their memories of incidents, sometimes slightly contradictory, sometimes complimentary, sometimes challenging. That's a lovely addition to the book as well. Yes. So it's great, particularly for you and the family to have that.
Most definitely.
What I really want to sort of come to conclude is, what do you think your father's lasting legacy is as a Buccaneer pilot, as a Royal Navy officer, and as a dad?
Legacies work on many levels, don't they? So as a Buccaneer pilot, I mean, I'll include in that as a mate, as a squadron, you know, as a mate of, on the squadron, one of a great bunch of mates. I think there's a legacy there. I mean, everyone you serve with, whatever it's in, whatever line of work you're in, everyone you work with, serve with, makes their mark upon you. We end up as products, molded and shaped by our instructors and our peers. So I'd like to think, well, in fact, it's inevitable that there are his mates out there still, Stuart, Clive, the others who appear, Mike Sharp, Robin Cox, that there are numerous there who in some way still carry a bit of my dad with them, from conversation they had, from flying tips they swapped, or even if it's just about, like, you know, the type of beer they preferred, or, you know, the pubs, their favorite pubs, anything, you know, people you've socialized with and flown with, worked with and played hard with, they leave their mark upon you. It's been said, Stuart said he had high professional standards, but he didn't take himself too seriously and had a good sense of humor. Arthur Davis, his observer on Eagle, echoed that as well. So I hope that's a personal legacy amongst his mates. As a dad, of course, I am him. He is me. You know, we are to an extent one and the same. I think I share some of his sense of humor. Of course, I reconstruct him from, the memories of others, but also my own memories. You know, everything's a reconstruction. So the book reconstruction of my dad, which, you know, I've had a go at, is really a reconstruction that I carry. And that's what's set down. It's a very personal, that story is my story. Yes, at top level, it's my dad's story, but actually there's a backstory to it. It is what you are reading is my story of getting reacquainted with my dad in a way that I put on hold for four decades. That is the emotional power that I've put into that story. My mm-hmm. need to discover is in there. And legacy. His legacy for me, I can hear his voice still. He's very present. He's so present for me. I can almost reach out and touch him. So that'll never leave me. To an extent, I'm haunted by my dad and that marvelous, wonderful time as part of the Royal Navy family. Not all hauntings are a bad thing. I would not swap it for the world. I would not change it for the world. Having been part of that Royal Navy family, and having my dad and what I remember about him being shown inside his helicopter, that kind of thing, it's such a marvelous life for a young guy. For a little boy, it doesn't get much better than that. And I wouldn't have swapped that for the world. So that his legacy on me works on different levels there. Dad, guy who can fly stuff, guy who can show me exciting stuff, sit me in cockpits and things. Wider legacy, I think, hopefully, I've kind of written him a legacy in that his story was always there in that drawer. At my mother's home in Suffolk, it was there, it was dormant, it was waiting to be rediscovered. But there you have a story that keys into the Cold War, the setting of the sun on the British Empire. The final fling, if you like, that Far East cruise covering the withdrawal of the Far East fleet, well, with the British withdrawal from Oman, standing by in case things kicked off, as well as flying a lot of training missions. And that is, that's kind of there to be read, not through the lens of, actually through the lens of a biographer or a documentary filmmaker. It's there intimately because it's drawn from, he was writing one-to-one and not writing for a military person either. So it's not, although it's packed with operational detail, it's not excessively jargon laden. It's not, it's not difficult to get your head around. He explains it in clear terms because that's exactly what he's trying to do.
You don't need to be an aviation geek to read this book.
You absolutely do not. Although the richness of incidental and operational detail is there, and I definitely wanted it all in. And I certainly, in the final chapter, I certainly wanted to do, as far as was within my capability, a proper job that would satisfy people who can fly, who have flown, who know the limitations and the dangers of flying, and know about systems and procedures, and could sort of read it and think, I get what happened. And you know, hopefully it can pass off, which is my intention, as it could have been written by my dad.
Well, you've brought that story out of that drawer and you've brought it to the world, and you must be really, really proud of your father, and you should be a really, really proud of the job you've done in bringing this book to life and to the people of this world. So thanks very much for that, Simon. So let's leave it there. Before we go, though, just want to find out where we can find you on online, on social media. Where can we find a copy of the book?
In reverse order, the book's published by Pen and Sword under their Airworld imprint. Marvelous pedigree. I'm proud to be published by them. I sit in honourable company. So it's available direct from Pen and Sword, but it's also available from all the usual suspects, anywhere where you might buy books. You can even find it on the shelves in one or two bookstores. I've yet to actually see it. I'm kind of holding off. I definitely want that experience of seeing it there, that surreal, magical experience, because I can hardly believe it exists, even though I've got a copy right in front of me, just to my left here. But it's very much available and out there. Social media wise, God, I'll answer that very quickly. At the moment, I'm proud to be contactable through Pen and Sword, and very proud to be on the podcast, I have to say. Again, I sit with honourable company. I'm humbled, actually, to sit now alongside some guys with some amazing stories.
Simon, justifiably so. Justifiably so. You've done a fabulous job. But listen, we'll put links to Pen and Sword and the book in the show notes and on the podcast. We'll also put a link to the book into our bookshop as well. We'll promote it that way. And also, if it's okay with you, if anyone does want to get in contact, if they get in contact with us through the usual sources, we'll pass those messages on.
I'm more than happy with that. I'm afraid I'm lagging behind the curve by several decades, but mainly because still with a full-time job on the go, and this, I couldn't do justice to social media presence. My social media presence would be like a like an unfurnished flat with bare floorboards.
I would
rather function like a 1970s author. After all, it's a 1970s story. Albeit you can email me via the publisher and your good selves, of course.
Okay, we'll do that. That's it then. We'd like to thank White Hearts, as well as the extended family of supporters, including Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian and Simon Jakubowski at the Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club. As I've asked many times, we need your support. Please leave us a review or feedback on your podcast player Facebook page or through social media. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Tim, Gareth and Ellie on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. And that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Simon.
Thank you. Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.